Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Good morning. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program here. I'm delighted to welcome you all to yet another of our series on Cuba. Cuba, an international perspective is the title for today. In the course of the series, we've tried to give a different viewpoint, to reorient the vision that Washington audiences are able to acquire on Cuba by including a considerable number of participants from outside of the Cuba-U.S. Circle. Many Canadians, many participants from the United Kingdom, other parts of Europe, as a means of broadening the vision that we in Washington are able to acquire. And today is another step in that direction. We're very fortunate to have with us three leading diplomats who will be able to comment on different aspects of relations with Cuba from the point of view of their countries and also from the internal Cuban perspective. We have with us Mr. Bruce Levy, who's the Minister Counselor for Head of the Political Section of the Canadian Embassy here in Washington, the Honorable Diana Melrose, Ambassador of the United Kingdom to Cuba, and Mr. Luc Veron, Minister Counselor and Head of the Political and Development Section, the Delegation of the European Commission in Washington. The speakers will go in alphabetical order, which is our usual operating procedure. We'll start with Mr. Levy, who, as I said, is the head of the political section, the Canadian Embassy in Washington. He's been here in Washington since August 2005, was previously director of the U.S. Relations Division and the U.S. Transboundary Divisions at the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade in Ottawa. Career Foreign Service Officer. He's been posted in Manila, Bangkok, and Hanoi, and has also worked on Western Hemisphere affairs at the Privy Council. Ambassador Melrose is, as I said before, currently a British ambassador to Cuba, has had a 10-year career in British foreign policy. She headed British and Foreign Commonwealth Offices in Enlargement and Southeast Asia Group and the Department of International Development's International Trade Department. She's also been the director of the FCO's policy planning staff. Before joining the British Foreign Service, she spent 18 years at Oxfam UK, serving as policy director, and she has an MA in Latin American Studies from the Institute of Latin American Studies in London. Mr. Luc Veron, Minister, Counselor, Political, and Head of the Political and Development Section of the European Commission in Washington, D.C. since August 2007. He served as Deputy Head and then Acting Head of the Unit for Relations with the United States and Canada in the International Relations Department of the European Commission. He has a master's degree in economics and international relations and has earned postgraduate degrees in economics as well. He's a career diplomat in the European Commission. So we're delighted again to have these three distinguished speakers. We'll begin with Mr. Levy, and then we will continue as we conclude the opening remarks. There'll be an opportunity for all three to answer your questions. Thank you again very much for having come. Mr. Levy?
Peter, thank you very much, and congratulations, first of all, for your series on Cuba. I'm a little confused. I thought this was a healthcare forum, but I've adjusted my remarks, and we're delighted to be included in your other country's policy panel, and what I propose to do is keep my remarks quite short, and would be happy to engage in discussion or questions and answers afterwards. Canada's engagement with Cuba began as far back as the 18th century, when ships from our Atlantic provinces traded codfish and beer for rum and sugar. This early trading relationship led to the establishment of trade offices in the early 1900s. Formal diplomatic relations were established by Cuba in 1942, and Canada reciprocated 3 years later with our first mission in the Caribbean in Havana. Thus began what is now 64 years old, I think, of basically uninterrupted bilateral relations. And as people may know, in fact, Canada and Mexico are the only two countries of the hemisphere not to have severed relations with Cuba following the revolution in 59. And when the U.S. embargo was imposed against Cuba in the early 1960s, Canada decided to maintain engagement. This was, I think, an important decision and one that basically set us on a slightly different path in regard to Cuba policy. Jumping ahead to the 1970s, the relationship began to mature and diversify. Charter flights started taking Canadian tourists to the island, for some reason always in the wintertime, and Canada initiated a development cooperation program that brought academics and technical experts from both sides together for the first time. Not to say that the relationship has not had its low points. After only 4 years in operation, Canada's aid to the island was suspended from 1978 all the way until 1994 due to Cuba's military presence in Angola. What have been our guiding principles through the decades? Like the U.S. and others, we hope to see a peaceful and sustainable transition in Cuba to what we strongly believe in ourselves, a democratic and free market-based system. We use our many links to the island to promote our values and models of governance, human rights, and social justice. Canada has pursued a two-track approach to Cuba. The first track involves strategic engagement between Canadian officials and key decision makers within the Cuban government, essentially to push for change and discussion from the top down. High-level visits in both directions are an important component of that engagement. For example, in 2005, Cuba's former Minister of Foreign Affairs, Felipe Perez Roque, visited Canada. In May 2007, our Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs had a very productive four-day visit to Cuba, including a three-hour discussion on human rights with the foreign minister. In July of 2007, Cuba's then Minister of Government, now Vice President Ricardo Cabrizas, came to Canada for a round of high-level meetings. And in April of last year, our agriculture minister visited Cuba to sign an MOU on agricultural cooperation. And this was followed by a visit to Canada by Cuba's first deputy minister, Bruno Rodriguez, now the foreign minister. Most recently, Cuba's former Minister of International Trade came to Canada for meetings with his Canadian counterpart and other ministers. And we are actively considering various options for future ministerial travel in both directions. Each of these visits provides the Canadian government with an opportunity to develop relationships of influence with key figures in the Cuban government to deliver our views on democratization and human rights and other issues. The second track of our two-track approach involves engaging Cuban civil society, academics and economists, among others, to build capacity and demand for change from the bottom up. One of the most important tools in this regard is the existence of 8 Canadian studies centers located in universities across the island. They make available information on Canada, its democratic and free market models, and strong social programs. There is also a public diplomacy program that includes academic exchanges and cultural outreach. No other country that I'm aware of, including Cuba's socialist allies, has this extensive in-country presence, network of contacts, and access to the public. One particularly potent past example of Canada's engagement is our funding of a successful 10-year program in the 1990s to support the teaching of market economics at the University of Havana. We like to think, perhaps immodestly, that we contributed to the creation of a new generation of technocrats that is not only familiar with the theories of Karl Marx, but also those of Adam Smith. As the Canadian government makes it a point to speak to all sectors in a society, the Canadian Embassy in Havana also meets regularly with dissidents to monitor their situation and demonstrate Canada's robust support for those with alternative views. We have other important connections to Cuba. At more than $2 billion, Canada is a leading source of foreign direct investment and a key trading partner with about $1.7 billion in bilateral trade last year. We are also Cuba's largest source of tourists. Last year, approximately 818,000 Canadians, again, concentrated over just a few months, nearly 35% of all visitors to Cuba visited. Development assistance, finally, also has a crucial role to play. Our $12 million aid program is one of the largest in Cuba. It focuses on modernizing the economy through support to key state institutions and contributing to the development of the eastern provinces, in particular, the region with the lowest human development indicators. During the 1990s, we supported the development of a nascent taxation system that will be required if a higher degree of private enterprise is to be sustained. The hurricanes of 2008 inflicted severe damage to Cuba. It could be years before the island totally recovers. In addition to our annual general contributions to the World Food Program and the UN's Central Emergency Response Fund, Canada contributed $1 million to support emergency and recovery efforts. So let me conclude. Engaging with Cuba hasn't always been smooth sailing. Canada's insistence on continuing to meet with dissidents has caused occasional problems with the Cuban government, as have our critical statements at the United Nations Human Rights Council. However, our two countries make it a policy to speak to each other respectfully, openly, and frankly, even on issues where we differ. In the end, the relationship carries on, both sides valuing the connection despite our differences. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Ambassador Melrose?
I'm going to obviously talk about the UK bilateral relationship with Cuba and offer some thoughts on the US, the direction of US policy, since I was kindly invited to. But I would like to set this first in the context of how I see Cuba today, having just come from Havana. The most pressing issue is the economic crisis, and this is absolutely key. Cuba hasn't faced anything as bad since the early 90s. Why is it important to set the context? Is because it clearly is going to influence, be a key influence on decisions that the Cuban government takes over its foreign policy relations, and, of course, the extent to which it decides that it's in its own interests to implement internal reforms. Now, the trade deficit is spiraling out of control. Imports were a staggering 80% of foreign trade in the first quarter of this year, and that's the collapse in the price of nickel, but also a fall in the revenue that Cuba is getting from tourists. And this could, combined with other factors, cost the Cuban economy some $1 billion this year, and that's equivalent to a quarter of all their trade. So this is very significant. There's an acute liquidity crisis. Cuba is defaulting on its debts. Foreign companies aren't being paid. President Raul Castro's productivity drive has failed to show any results so far. And most critically, agricultural production outside the small private sector remains highly inefficient. Food security is being prioritized, and hence the importance of imports of U.S. agricultural products. There's been cuts, if you look at the situation facing Cubans on the island, there have been cuts in increasingly unaffordable food subsidies, food rations, and austerity measures to save electricity. The new political rallying cry is save or die. This daily economic hardship is really the overriding concern of Cubans on the island. They are paid in Cuban national currency a salary equal to $17 a month in non-convertible currency. Now, that means it would take a week's wages to buy a pound of butter. And you need convertible currency to buy many foodstuffs and essential household goods. This is why remittances from the United States are so critical, and the Obama administration's freeing up of restrictions on remittances and travel have been extremely popular and fueled hopes for more. Cuba has a great advantage of a highly educated and a very healthy workforce, and the Cuban government deserves credit for that. However, that human capital is wasted by the heavy restrictions on any form of private enterprise. And rather than opening up to ease the current crisis, what we're seeing is a recent crackdown on some of the small-scale economic activity, like the street vendors selling agricultural products. So there is growing anger and frustration, which could be destabilizing, but the government is exerting very tight control. By comparison to concerns over the economic hardships, there is a relative lack of concern expressed over civil and political rights. There's a lot of political apathy amongst young people that we talk to that are not deferential to their leaders, that don't see a future on the island and want out, obviously with clear implications for the US in terms of migration. And, of course, another reason why they would be less keen to volunteer their opinions to foreigners like myself is that they fear reprisals in criticizing the system in a country where access to jobs, housing, just about everything is state-controlled. There's surprisingly little awareness of the very fragmented internal opposition. However, with very limited freedom of expression and very limited access to information, you can see why. Only 2% of Cubans have access to the internet. There's been no real change in the human rights situation, a slight decrease in the number of political prisoners, but an increase in short-term detentions. From our reading of the situation, structural reform looks very unlikely anytime soon, short of a surprise outcome to the party Congress, which is due to take place this year. And it will be interesting, the next big set-piece speech that President Raul Castro is due to make is this Sunday on July the 26th. So that is the context for our engagement. I would describe UK engagement with Cuba as constructive but principled engagement. Now, what do I mean by that? Practical bilateral collaboration of the type that Bruce has described on issues where we have shared objectives. Countering the illicit trade in narcotics is one very key area. There are others like child protection, a shared concern about climate change and the need to get a good outcome this year in Copenhagen. At the same time, it goes hand in hand with an unwavering focus in promoting human rights consistent with the EU common position. So I regularly raise human rights concerns with the Cuban government, as do our ministers when they meet their counterparts outside the island. Cuba is one of the very, very few foreign policy issues where is the clear divergence in policy between the United States and the United Kingdom. We have maintained uninterrupted diplomatic relations with Cuba since independence in 1902. And Labour and Conservative governments in the UK have consistently voted against the US embargo in the General Assembly. I should say that we clearly share the same goals, but our approach to the tactics are very, very different. We have, like Canada, normal trade relations, trade and investment relations with Cuba, but very, very small by comparison with Canada or our EU partner, Spain. Or, ironically, with the United States, now the fifth largest trading partner of Cuba. Major British companies and our SMEs do business in Cuba and see potential to do more. They're involved in joint ventures with state owned Cuban companies, And despite what is a very difficult business operating environment and the strong disincentive of Helms-Burton extraterritorial sanctions, which I should say UK legislation makes it illegal for British companies to implement Helms-Burton, as does EU law. Like Canada, we have a significant number of visitors to Cuba. We are, in fact, the second largest source of tourists, 200,000 a year, more than Spain, which is perhaps surprising. And also a lot of cultural links. We had the Royal Ballet in Cuba in the last week, which was described in the state-controlled party newspapers as the biggest cultural event of the year. And I should say there is huge excitement at the prospect of the New York Philharmonic going to Cuba in the autumn. Now, as we see it, this bilateral engagement creates a more conducive environment for having the difficult conversations, and they are difficult, about human rights, political and economic freedoms. No UK minister has visited the island since 2005. Why? Because the Cuban government is now making official programs conditional on visiting ministers and officials not meeting the opposition. That, to us, is not acceptable. On principle, we engage with dissidents, with the opposition, both to get a wider picture of what is happening on the island, but also to afford them some protection against harassment and arrest. And that is a standard part of my job, my daily working life. But all the signs are that the reform process will be driven from within the government, within the party, not by a very weak and fragmented opposition. Therefore, to us, it makes compelling sense, bilaterally and for the European Union, to engage and develop a frank but constructive political dialogue with the Cuban government on an agenda that must include human rights, but also go wider for shared interests like climate change. And just as Bruce had mentioned, to us, tone and language are all important. Mutual respect. There is no point in lecturing and talking past each other. It gets us precisely nowhere. The fact that the Cuban government has been extremely skillful in building its foreign policy alliances, to our view, makes it ever more important that the European Union has an engagement with the Cuban government, because with their other alliances and key players, this is an uncritical engagement for the most part, certainly what you see in public. So it's important for us that we raise issues like the release of political prisoners on a regular basis. But let's have a reality check here. The EU has little to show for engagement over the past year. There's very little that the Cuban government wants from the European Union that it doesn't already have. Trade and investment, development assistance, which was resumed last autumn, and our continuing opposition to the US embargo. So if there is any external actor, and that's an if too, that has potential leverage, it is the United States. Let me quickly pass to some thoughts, if I may share these, on the future of US-Cuba relations. President Obama's signaling of a fresh approach, followed by his early announcements on freeing up travel and remittances for Cuban Americans, was extremely popular. We were very encouraged by the initial reaction of the Cuban government as well, and the fact that last week such positive migration talks were held at a very senior level. The first Vice Minister, Dagoberto Rodriguez, who knows the US very well, came to New York for those meetings. We very much agree with the compelling analysis in a series of reports out of Washington this year, amongst others from Senator Lugar, the Lexington Institute, Brookings from Jake Colvin, and no doubt others that I've not been lucky enough to see, that attempts to politically isolate Cuba and the economic embargo have not served U.S. strategic interests. U.S. companies are certainly losing opportunities, and I don't know if this has been quantified to what extent this is the case. But as we see it, as close partners on the security front, the huge security challenges we face, again, resources being diverted away from those major challenges towards policing the embargo. The embargo, as we see it, has harmed people on the island, but perhaps most crucially for U.S. foreign policymakers, it has given the Cuban government a very convenient scapegoat. It can blame all the economic ills and hardships that Cuban people are suffering on the embargo and evade responsibility for its economic mismanagement of the economy. And it's much easier to retain political legitimacy while suppressing fundamental human rights and freedoms if people on the island are made to feel that they're under threat, under attack from the most important, powerful country just 90 miles to the north. And this, of course, is all the more so in the light of history and very strong nationalist sentiments on the island. So changes in U.S. policy towards engagement and dismantling the embargo, including Helms-Burton, would also be very popular with U.S. allies, and as it would give us the possibility of more convergence and moves towards a more multilateral approach to these challenges. Clearly, there's lots of very creative thinking in Washington on ways forward to advance U.S. strategic interests and to help promote positive change on the island. I see a very comprehensive menu of options, for example, in the Lexington report. Knowing I was coming here to have the pleasure of talking to you, I asked a range of people on the island, including dissidents and the opposition, what do you want? Tell me three things you would like the U.S. administration to do. What was I told? I'm going to home in on what dissidents said, because I think you can be clear that the Cuban people want more economic linkages. But the dissident said, I think reflecting also what Cuban people want, is progressive practical steps. They honed in on much more people-to-people links and an end of travel restrictions on U.S. citizens. That's as initial steps, and I found it interesting that these are issues that are on the table in Congress. Cuban people, I think this contact would help dispel some of the fears that Cuban people have about change. They are not used to change. They want change, but they're fearful of the unknown, especially losing some of the positives, like the free access to health and education, and with a dire housing situation, fearing they could lose their homes to returning Cuban Americans. From our perspective, there's a lot more that the U.S. could get out of practical collaboration with Cuba, particularly on counter-narcotics, where the Cubans are very good and see the primary beneficiary of their work as benefiting the United States. Trade and investment links, I think, as we found, would create opportunities and better-paid jobs for Cubans on the island, and importantly, help empower them and lessen their dependence on the state. Now, Having said that, I fully appreciate that for us we're talking about a foreign policy issue, but here in the US things are very different, and it takes a lot of political capital to make policy changes on such a divisive domestic issue. And it would obviously, it does take the administration and the Congress into the very difficult terrain that we have discussed of the extent to which moves by the US should be conditioned on human rights improvements. I put this to the dissidents and said, and these include former political prisoners who've suffered greatly under this regime, they said that in their opinion, the US shouldn't condition every move on specific action by the Cuban government. Why? Because from their perspective, if the ball is left in the court of the Cuban government, there's a huge risk of a continuing stalemate. Because what does the Cuban government fear? And that's losing control of the change process. It's possible, according to these Cuban observers, that the government could prefer the status quo to being wrong-footed by unilateral moves to lift the embargo. So to conclude, from my conversations with people on the island, I see a big appetite for phased steps by the United States to increase practical collaboration and particularly to dismantle the embargo, as they'd be positive in themselves, but also likely to create an unstoppable momentum for change in Cuba. And all importantly, to help drive movement towards fundamental political and economic freedoms. So thank you.
Madam Ambassador, thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Veron.
Thank you very much. Congratulations to CIS for this very interesting series on Cuba, and thank you for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to be here. I will keep my remarks extremely short because for two reasons. Number one, it's always a danger to have two diplomats from the EU on the same panel because, as I know, especially in the multilateral context, the Americans are always very critical of additionality, and they don't like to have, you know, a member state and then the commission speaking because, you know, it's a bit longish. And we say basically the same thing. I was fascinated by the remarks that the ambassador just made, and I think this is probably the best illustration. The UK-Cuba relationship is probably the best illustration of our EU common position. So I would like to limit myself to four basic remarks. One is about how we characterize the EU policy towards Cuba. The second is about one word about our development aid towards Cuba. The third is about the relaunch of the political dialogue with Cuba. And finally, I think the ambassador made very interesting remarks on this about U.S.-Cuba relations. First, the ambassador has said very clearly, but also my colleague Bruce Levy, we in the EU are in favor of constructive engagement, not a policy of coercion and sanctions. And that has always been the case and remains the basis of EU policy towards Cuba. The EU policy position is based on the common position agreed by the member states in 1996. In 2008, June 2008, about a year ago, we lifted the 2003 diplomatic measures against Cuba by our council conclusions, which led to the relaunching of the EU-Cuba political dialogue and the resumption of European Community-Cuba cooperation in October 2008. We recently adopted, a couple of weeks ago, on the 15th of June, Council conclusions in the context of the review of our common position. And we have confirmed the EU decision to continue the political dialogue with Cuba and welcome the resumption of cooperation with the country. Second remark about development assistance. Humanitarian aid of an amount of 4 million euro to support Cuban families affected by the hurricanes was made available between the end of October 2008 and the beginning of January 2009. Some projects are underway, and they concern basically the rehabilitation of basic agriculture and shelter. Following this immediate humanitarian intervention, a set of projects in the area of rehabilitation and reconstruction, food security, have been identified jointly with the Cuban authorities to be implemented in 2009. There is an indicative amount of 36 million euro. Projects, and it's important, will be implemented through European NGOs and UN agencies. Third remark, the position towards political dialogue with Cuba. Our own analysis, the Commission analysis, is that there is an evolving situation in Cuba and that it is important to support and accompany the ongoing process. The Commission is of the opinion that within the framework of a mature, frank, and holistic EU-Cuba political dialogue without preconditions, that all pertinent questions, including those related to human rights, should be discussed. This has been confirmed by the constructive spirit which prevailed during the two ministerial troikas that we had in Paris in October 2008 and Brussels in May 2009, where human rights questions were openly discussed by both sides, along with other bilateral and multilateral issues. And it's a process that needs to be pursued and consolidated. It's important in the present conjuncture that the international community has the possibility to accompany the ongoing economic reform process in Cuba. And one of the areas which the Commission may support through development cooperation is the reform of the agricultural sector, as an important issue that was mentioned by the ambassador a moment ago. Fourth short remark, U.S.-Cuba relations. I don't want to repeat what both my colleagues have said, but I want to say something more with regard to our deep interest in the decisions of President Obama concerning Cuba and the offer for dialogue expressed by the current administration and the Cuban government. We understand that the first session of EU-US talks on migration issues has taken place last week. We further understand that the Cuban side has proposed to enlarge those talks to other issues and that the U.S. may consider those proposals. The EU obviously welcomed the resumption of the dialogue on migration, which in some ways is close to our policy of constructive engagement. The European Union also has also noted in its last Council conclusions the decision taken by the General Assembly of the Organization of American States in San Pedro Sula early June to terminate the resolution 1962, which excluded the government of Cuba from participation in the inter-American system. And finally, it's fair to say that we do have regular dialogues with the U.S. government and the State Department on Cuba. We will continue to have that, as on most countries, and we welcome the opportunity, of course, to hear further on the outcome of the resumed dialogue between the U.S. and Cuba. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Véran. Ladies and gentlemen, the floor is open for questions. Please identify yourself by name and your affiliation. We'll start with the gentleman here. The microphone is coming right here.
My name is Donald Finberg. I'm a member of the Cosmos Club. Was going to be having a seminar on Cuba. My question is to all of you, and particularly to Ambassador Milrose. Do we know when the conference is going to take place, the party conference? And what, if anything, do you think, by way of change, may come out of it?
The answer is no, we don't know. It was meant to be at the end of last year, and then it was postponed. I asked the young communist organization whether they'd started the preparations, and they said, no, we haven't had instructions. So we don't know. And what will come out of it again? Cuba is quite an unusual country. It has quite an opaque political system. So this is where you get into the guessing game. Clearly, there is a debate going on within the party, but it's hard to see which way it would go. I would think, if anything, it would be on the economic reform agenda. I think I've signaled quite clearly that from our reading of the situation, it's unlikely that we would see any major political, any political change being announced. So, sorry, this is not easy.
Gentlemen here. Bring a microphone.
Okay. Norman Bailey, and thank you, Peter, for referring to me as a gentleman with the Institute of World.
It depends on
my question is. Institute of World Politics. First of all, I want to thank CSIS and Peter for this fascinating series. Secondly, I want to thank Ambassador Melrose for her extremely frank and frankly fascinating comments. And I have a question for her. Not long ago, Raul, in response to President Obama saying that he would like to start a dialogue with Cuba, appeared on television and pounding the table said and repeated several times, "We're ready to talk about everything, 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 everything," and he repeated it several times. A day later, Fidel said, Raul was misunderstood. Now, quite frankly, it was totally impossible to misunderstand what Raul was saying. My question is, in your opinion, what extent is Raul really president of Cuba, or is, with reference at any rate to certain matters, is Fidel Castro still running things?
We've very much focused on the reactions of the Cuban government, and Raul is the president, and thought that this was a very... It's not the first time the Cuban government has said that it's open to dialogue, but this was a very, very express mention that implied a discussion of human rights or all the problems. And we take that at face value, that this was a very positive reaction. And the initial comments of Fidel after the U.S. elections were also positive and constructive. But, yes, you're quite right that there was some reining back. Again, it's difficult to know what Fidel's presence means in terms of a restraining influence on his brother in the government. But I think for us, Raul is the president of Cuba. And what have we seen? We've seen a very positive engagement in the migration talks, as I understand from colleagues in state. So I think that's where we would focus attention, dealing with the government.
I certainly agree with what Ambassador Melrose just said. And I'd just add a point that there's clearly, among many, a lot of pent-up sort of eagerness, anticipation about what the Obama approach means, and a wish that you can go from, you know, essentially isolationism to full-scale dialogue the next day. I'm not suggesting that's your point, but I think that element is there. And I would, whatever that meant, that little back and forth between the brothers, may be a little bit moot at this point. I think, as Ambassador Melrose indicated, and as I think she was recommending, and we would certainly agree, it's likely to be a cautious step-by-step approach. They had the migration talks. We understand the next set of talks will be particularly exciting. It'll be on reestablishing direct mail service. You know, not the sexiest issues, and a long way from talking about human rights and lifting economic embargoes and so on, but it may take a whole lot of small steps before they get to the big ones.
I am Frank Alzona with the Center for Free Cuba. Like to again thank CSIS for an excellent program, and I enjoy very much what everybody has said. I have one very basic question. Before I do that, I'd like to just mention that sometimes the word isolation is used in regard to U.S.-Cuba policy. Yet the U.S. intersection in Havana is the largest diplomatic mission in Cuba. And the U.S., whatever you might want to call isolation, that's part of a cold word on the debate on Cuba. I don't believe the U.S. is isolating Cuba. The U.S. broadcast to Cuba like it did to Eastern Europe. And there are many other things, that the money that's sent from the United States, that's not isolation. My question really to the panel is, twofold. One, Ambassador Melrose talks about the dissidents, and I have statements from the dissidents that differ from the message that she brought out from some dissidents. So I would like to know to what extent are there people who disagree with those recommendations among the dissidents. Secondly, on the European Commission, I talked to Martin Paloš, who's the Czech ambassador to the United Nations often, and apparently there is a debate. There's a debate among those countries who suffer under communism and the other more traditional countries. And I thought it would have been good to hear something about this discussion ongoing. Finally, on the issue of constructive engagement and convergence and companies in Cuba, bringing the United States policy toward the European model. If I understand it, the European policy, as expressed by the British and the French, is doing business with Cuba while discussing human rights and so on. What has been accomplished during this process of 50 years by all these millions of tourists that have gone to Cuba? Have they brought Cuba a step closer to freedom and reform, as is suggested by the recommendation of U.S. tourists, on empowerment of Cuban workers? I think one of you talked about investment as empowerment. Do those Cuba's workers have a chance to organize a labor union, collective bargaining? Do they get paid directly by the foreign companies, or does the Cuban government receive the money and gets a very small amount to them? I think that it was good to hear the reality check that Ambassador Melrose spoke. I think there's ample space for debate and discussion. I would not put a lot of emphasis on the migration talks. There have been many migration talks in the past, but on the facts. The president, the White House has said, the ball is in Havana's court. That's what he said. The president asked the Cuban government for a couple of responses on political prisoners and lowering their fee. Now, can we have a reality check also on both European policy, as I indicated, and also on what the White House has requested? Thank you, and I really appreciate the comments of everyone.
Thank you. Well, there are three questions. The dissidents, the debate within the EU, or the supposed debate, and the constructive engagement. I don't know, perhaps we could take them in that order if anyone wants to begin.
You're absolutely right. The U.S. interest section is the biggest mission, and it's hard for them that they're confined to Havana to not be able to see wider Cuba, and obviously Cuban diplomats are within the beltway here. But, yes, I mean, we talk to regularly to the U.S. interest section, and then you move to the dissidents, and obviously, you know very, very well, the opposition, the dissident movement, is extremely split. Some of it is infiltrated. Some of it is, they say different things. I talk to a range of people, but particularly those with a serious analysis of what change could look like, who articulate a new direction. But I couldn't agree with you more. You will not hear two answers the same. And I think that is part of the problem, that it is such a weak and divided opposition. And you mentioned our colleagues who've experienced communism in Eastern Europe. And they often say to us and that it's very hard to compare the experience of Cuba, perhaps with the exception of Bulgaria, because there isn't a strong, united opposition with the political legitimacy that can drive the change that that's easier for outside actors to engage with. So I think you're making a very fair point. I'm sure you want. Let's leave Luke to answer the question on the EU, but you might want me to pitch in there too, and also on what if we actually gained, because I did say let's be real about what we've gained.
Thank you very much for your question. Very interesting question. just. One remark first. I don't think you heard the French position here. I'm not sure the French position is different from what you expressed here, Ambassador, but I'm more modestly, I was expressing the views of the European Union. And I would be at pain to name an issue on which there is no debate in the EU. And I don't think Cuban policy is any different from any other policy debate that we have within the EU. Healthcare is not one of them because it's not within the jurisdiction of the European Union, but I'm sure if we had that, we would have a debate on that too. No, I think there is a diversity of views, a diversity not of views, because we, as I expressed very clearly, and there is no doubt about this, and that there should be no doubt in your mind that we have a common position. So what I expressed is the view of the 27 member states of the European Union, and the Czech Republic is one of them. So there is no question about that. But there is a diversity, as you rightly said, and the ambassador confirmed that. There is a diversity of sensitivities, and this is, I would believe, the richness of our debates within the EU with regard to such an issue as Cuba. Now, you say, what has been accomplished? I'm not sure that is a fair question, actually, because in the academic world, it's always very difficult to evaluate the impact of foreign policy options. And you have to compare the policy options that you have with regard to the objectives. And 50 years of embargo have not produced a lot of results. So that's something which is, and comparing that to the lack of result of our approach, I think, is somewhat unfair, in my opinion. We have a different approach, and we are a farther power than the U.S. with regard to the situation in the Caribbean. So I think it's not entirely fair to point to the lack of result of our policy with compared to what is would always be my answer to this. So
to the goals of the European Union. You talk about empowerment of Cuban people, Cubans being empowered.
Right.
Your policy have been in place for 50 years?
Our policy has been in place since 1996, which is not exactly 50 years. But I'm talking about the EU common position of 1996. And this common position has actually evolved. We have put more pressure at some point. We have released some pressure. We have adjusted our policy. So it has not even been, a sort of it has been a continuum, but we have adjusted the pressure, and I think we will continue to do that. We will continue to stick to the reality on the ground. That's what I wanted to say. Thanks.
I guess just quickly on the on tourism, because we're the monsters in the room on that. It's an interesting debate. It's gone on. I would say. And in a very cowardly way, I would skirt it entirely by saying I don't think we see tourism as an instrument of foreign policy. Now, having said that, I'll say that the situation in the United States is different for two reasons. Essentially, one is the issue of family ties, which doesn't really come into it with Canadian tourists to Cuba. And then second, I think the issue that Ambassador Melrose alluded to, which is that there's a lot of apprehension, I think, towards change among Cuban people. Cuban people who, as I understand it, tend to be very well disposed towards Americans, perhaps not always towards their government, but towards Americans, and yet are also worried for a number of reasons that she enumerated about what might be coming down the road with this talk of change and so on, and therefore the idea that maybe meeting more Americans, not just as tourists but in cultural and academic ties and so on, might be one way of slowly sort of lowering some of the barriers that are there for good or not so good reasons. And then quickly, just on the other interesting question, engagement versus non-engagement. I agree with my colleague from the EU. You can, of course, turn it around and say, what has the U.S. policy accomplished over 50 years? And obviously, Canada's policy speaks for itself. But I would say that nobody would argue that compared with the EU or Canada, the U.S. is the elephant in the room, and the suggestion that if any entity has the capacity from the outside to evince change in Cuba, it's probably the United States, and clearly the U.S. policy to date hasn't had the effect that they and in many ways the rest of us would have liked to have seen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dan Erickson with Inter-American Dialogue. And again, I enjoyed the opening presentations. I had two questions. The first was, in the spring, Cuba had a big cabinet shakeup. The foreign minister was fired. The long-serving Vice President Carlos Laje was fired. Several other officials were dismissed who dealt with foreign policy issues. And so I wanted to know what impact, if any, you see that having on Cuba's relations with your countries or with the European Union. What do you think the reasons were for that shakeup? And what does this mean for the future trajectory of Raúl's foreign policy? And then the second question was on Cuba and multilateral institutions. The Organization of American States was mentioned briefly, where Cuba is, I guess, halfway towards possibly being a member. There's other institutions like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, Inter-American Development Bank, where Cuba is currently banned from membership. What's the position of Canada, the UK, and the EU on Cuba's participation in international financial institutions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Cabinet shakeup and multilateral organizations.
Well, Dan, you're a very seasoned observer, as obviously Frank, of the Cuban political scene. It's none of us know for certain what the cabinet shakeup means, but there is one common pattern, I would say, that's very clear, and that's that all the changes, or the overwhelming majority of the changes, related to where I started, the economic crisis and food security. That was what it was all about. And to me, it expresses a realization on the part of President Castro that he has a real problem, given the mismanagement of the economy and the extent of the food security crisis. And he's clearly put round him people he trusts and people from the military who have made perhaps, you know, a better job, as he sees it, of running some parts of the state sector. And its impact on bilateral relations, I think, I don't think there's a big change there, because, as I was saying, we haven't seen any economic reforms, we haven't seen more opening, so it's let's wait and see. They're still busy restructuring ministries as at the moment. I think it's not for me to comment on the OAS. It seemed rather smart diplomacy, and it did put the ball in Havana's court. Mm-hmm. And certainly we have no position on the IDB. If I may take the liberty, Peter, I don't think we adequately answered the point that Frank made about free trade unions. You are absolutely right. There are no free trade unions, and that is deplorable and something that we highlight in our human rights report. The point I was making about foreign employers is that our presence does bring money into the economy. Now, you could say the state is the main beneficiary, but I would also point to direct benefits. Now, I mentioned that most Cubans are employed by the state and they're earning the equivalent of $17. Yes, we can only employ people that are, well, technically employed by the state, which is a very unusual situation. However, in addition to their peso salary, which is tiny, foreign employers pay a direct amount to their Cuban employees, and believe me, the wage, I'm talking about, you know, paying wages of, you know, more like 300 or more, say a month. This is a huge difference with the 17 you get in the state sector. So there are very direct benefits and the opportunity to engage and to be freer if you have that possibility of alternatives.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I think the OAS question actually is for Bruce, because we're only observers in the Organization of American States. However, I do completely share the analysis that the ambassador made on the significance of the result of the General Assembly in San Pedro Sula. And by the way, a very smart move, in my view, from the U.S. diplomatic efforts. And the Canadian efforts, I'm sure. On the restructuring of the reshuffling of the government, of course, there are only speculations, and it's a two-level game, as any kind of decision of that nature. There are domestic considerations. There are struggle of power considerations, I'm sure. For our part, from an observer and partner point of view, we noted that the new foreign minister is former ambassador to the UN, has certain knowledge of inside knowledge of the United States. It's a positive thing, I guess, in the context of the U.S. and Cuba happening a little bit their conversation. And another remark concerning Rodrigo Malmierca, the new Minister of Cooperation and Foreign Investment. We noted that he was formally ambassador to the EU, and we note that, that there could be some interesting consideration there too.
Yes. Go ahead. Do you want to reply?
I wasn't going to bring it up. I'll be quick, sir.
I can ask it again if you like. Now, Carl Sira from the National Center for State Courts, but formerly a USAID Foreign Service officer, and also with Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. So we got a good dose of both sides of the straits on the Cuba situation. I was interested particularly in the foreign assistance aspects, the international development program that Mr. Verón mentioned, that the EU was considering focusing on the agricultural sector, and in the context of the general economic collapse, plus the huge imports of agricultural commodities from the United States and elsewhere, I'd like to know what that program is going to focus on, and also what the other two countries, the two country representatives' foreign assistance programs have done in Cuba. That would be one. And then secondly, just curious about the effect and the reality of Venezuelan assistance to Cuba during this period. What has that been in your view? Thank you.
Americas. Yeah, no, I worked for the equivalent of AID for some time in the UK Department for International Development. Just last week, I was talking to Stefano Monservisi, who's the Director General from DG Development, and Luke's colleague from the Commission Office, and focusing on agriculture and food security. A lot of the effort there is to work to improve with the United Nations and NGOs to improve the productivity of the Cuban agricultural sector. To me, the interesting point Stefano made, and I think it relates to the conversation we were having, is that having this program gives the EU the opportunity for a dialogue about the nature of the reform program. And one of the big pushes in that conversation Stefano had was about the importance of decentralizing the agricultural reforms and resisting the heavy centralization that one sees. So that's just one example of don't let's ever overstate the leverage of a donor or the EU, but it does give some concrete chance of dialogue.
Dan, OAS. I was rapidly scanning through notes looking for something on the IFIs, and I'm afraid I don't have much, so I'm not going to be brave. echoing colleagues' comments, I mean, I don't think the outcome that is generally being applauded at the OAS was a foregone conclusion by any means, but at the end, I think it was the best conclusion. We were pleased. There are sort of always the main agenda items that everybody hears about, and then there's sort of the behind-the-scenes interesting developments. And one of them was, I think, the degree to which countries really worked together. Mexico was key there, the Mexican foreign minister directly involved. We like to think we played a constructive role, others as well. So, in that sense, that's not the headline story, but it was a key one. As I say, I'd be happy to check out the IFIs thing from people who know and get back to you. I do know, I think, on the Inter-American Development Bank, as I understand it, the assumption is full membership in the OAS as being the first step to Inter-American Development Bank funding. They would not be there at this stage. Again, we sort of say that the outcome in Honduras was positive in the sense that it now really leaves clearly the next step up to Cuba to decide if and at what pace they want to reintegrate into hemispheric activities, obviously starting with the OAS. On Venezuela, Venezuela has clearly been and continues to be a key partner of Cuba, especially during this period of economic crisis. That is a fact, and I don't have to make any editorial comment on Venezuela. People have their own opinions, but would only say what many others have said, which is you could say that that argues for greater engagement by others, including the United States, if indeed they are concerned about one or another country's particular influence on the island.
Thank you. Question here.
My name is Rob Fernandez. I'm with the Hispanic Community for Policy, and we're a nonpartisan group. And my question, I have just real two questions, and the second one is pretty quick. The first one, I want to use as a context everything that you've said so far, the positive side of the ledger and the negative side of the ledger, everything that's been said. And I want to add a couple of things. One is that a dictatorship or a single leader that has totalitarian rule can do whatever they want, say whatever they want, use any guinea pig they want. For example, if Venezuela, we don't have an embargo on Venezuela, yet Chavez will use whatever he wants to vilify the United States. And the second point of context that I want to add is U.S. is always Cuba is always compared to China, and Nixon went in and spoke with now and opened up the dialogue, and look what happened. You know, there's a lot more freedom in China than there is in Cuba, and we have direct trade, massive trade. But the difference between China and Cuba is their political structure, and there's a competitive system, even though it's a single-party system, and it's state-run country with a lot of human rights and free speech issues and movement. But nevertheless, in the national level, there's competition for the offices, and so at the provincial level, leading up to the national level. In Cuba, that's not the case at all, and there's no reason to believe that that's going to change at all either. So with that as a context, and you can disagree, of course, my question is, if we were to fully engage and increase our trade, which we're already the fifth largest trading partner with Cuba, but if we increase our trade and we open up complete dialogue and the embargo and continue with forward in that manner with Cuba, the problem, the long-term issue is what I'm concerned about. And Hispanics are concerned about the long-term issue. You can do all that, but what's the incentive for this leader to do anything other than say, okay, we'll take all that. We'll take all that. I mean, China's human rights record has not changed very much, even though they're changing from within. It's hard to see that change from within will occur with Cuba, given the fact that there's a single person ruling the country and that apparatus the way it is. So my question to you is, if we were to do that, how do you see long-term change happening without it being two generations or three generations down the road and subjecting Cubans to two or three generations of slow change, just a lot of talk, you know, as we see in other totalitarian countries. And the second question is a part of this. Now, given if that were the case, two generations, do you guys have, and given the fact that bold steps make changes in these kind of countries, like Reagan tear down this wall. You see, that's a bold step that you could see that was a bold step that made an impact versus long-term change. And the same with Nixon going to China. Again, I outlined why I think China's changed. But do you guys have a secret bold step that you hope somebody would do, including Obama or anybody, that would do that could make a more dramatic change similar to you know, tear down this wall or something like that? And thank you very much.
Thank you. I think you have a firm grasp of the world of diplomacy here.
I think it's a great question. I'm not sure, actually. I completely buy into the comparison between, I never did that myself, between China and Cuba. I I might have read it, but never was impressed by the comparison. I'll tell you a personal anecdote, which has nothing to do with Cuba. I'm part of the last generation of students of IR educated under the Cold War. I remember having an instructor in 1982, and we were at the highest point of the missile crisis between the Soviet Union and the U.S., the Pershing deployment, if you remember that, 1982. And my instructor said to our class, "You will know the end of the Soviet Empire." But we looked at him as if he was crazy. He was slightly older than us, and he said, "I will know the end of the Soviet Empire myself during my lifetime." And we looked at him, and then he lost it completely. And I joined the commission on the 1st of November, 1989, literally 3 days before the end of the Berlin Wall. So I can tell you things happen in international life. That's a personal anecdote which has nothing to do with Cuba. But if I had to make a prediction whether or not Cuba will change, my answer to this would be irrevocably yes.
Thank you very much. Question from the lady in the back.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'd just like to say,
a bit more Cuba-specific, maybe.
I think you posed an absolutely key dilemma, and that's why at this moment in time, I think we have more to share with the U.S., the EU, and Canada, because we have the same, we're seeking the same objective of working with the Cuban people. To achieve political and economic freedoms. And there is no magic bullet. I think we're all we're all struggling to find the right way forward. And, of course, what the EU has discussed this often, that there's a risk that when we move, in our case, to lift some measures that you could say were fairly symbolic, there is a risk that the Cuban government just pockets concessions. I think that is a very fair point. When you make the analogy of China, I think we think it's more likely that change on the island will be driven by economic engagement rather than anything else. But the time horizon is really a guessing game, isn't it?
Thank you. Thank the panel for their comments. I'm Adrienne Doherty with the Committee for Free Trade Unionism. We're working in the States to educate U.S. labor leaders about the free trade unionists who are in Cuba, many of whom are in jail. My comments relate to the European representatives. Brendan Barber, the leader of the TUC labor movement, spoke May 1st in Cuba and gave quite a revolutionary speech side by side with the Castro government to many thousands of people who appeared. I wondered if you ever heard from the dissidents about that as the ambassador to Cuba. Secondly, I have a question relating to the Cuban dissidents living in Spain and the Zapatero government now planning to go to Cuba in September, and the European Union policy relating to European leaders from many countries, Argentina and others who've been there who have not met with the dissidents and who've been criticized, I'm told, within the EU. I want to know what specifically the EU, what steps you're taking to stand firmly with the dissidents. What programs you do to try and help the dissidents, specifically Cuban dissidents in Spain who've been invited to come and live there, have no work permits and are finding great difficulty in living in Spain. So they feel somewhat betrayed by the government that has released them and negotiated their release, yet they come to Spain and they can't work really freely because they're restricted there as they live in Spain. So I want to ask the EU what your migration policy is with regard to once political prisoners are released. In the example of Spain and the Zapatero government, I know the unemployment is high in Spain, but if you bring political prisoners to your country and it's their first choice to live there, what does the EU do to protect them and give them a chance to have real life? This relates to trade union leaders who now live in Spain, who've been released, Pedro Pablo and several others.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Brendan Barber, yes, the General Secretary of our Trade Union Congress, was the first Secretary General to visit Cuba in the last 50 years since the revolution. There is a very strong historical solidarity links between the trade union movement in the UK and Cuba. And that is a lobby on the British government. What I would say, because I was right there, Brendan Barber and the trade union general secretaries came to my house, and we had quite a robust exchange about talking about the realities of Cuba and just what you're saying, the complete suppression of any free trade union movement. And as the EU and the UK, we regularly raise with the Cuban government the need to release of those 75 rounded up in 2003. As you know, they include people who tried to organize independent trade unions, which is indefensible. Specific objections from dissidents, nothing. But this is an issue we raise with the Cuban government and a lively discussion we have with British trade unions.
I'm sorry, I don't have any specific comment to say on the facts that you mentioned with regard to one of our member states. These are questions that you will have to discuss with that particular member state. With regard to the general approach, political refugees have the same rights as regular residents, so I don't see why that should be a problem. But this is a question that you would have to discuss with the Spanish government.
Thank you very much. We have time for one more question. The gentleman here.
Thank you. Larry Luxner, news editor of the Washington Diplomat and publisher of Cuba News. First, just two very quick questions. First is for Mr. Levy. Cuban purchases of U.S. food under the 2001 exemption to the embargo have increased dramatically. Understand last year, though most of that increase seems to be due to higher commodity prices rather than actual volume. To what extent has this hurt Canadian food exports to Cuba? Second question, Ambassador Melrose. You mentioned that there is a liquidity crisis in Cuba. Cuba is defaulting on its debt, and the trade deficit is spiraling out of control. Things seem to be the worst they've been in maybe 15 years since the special period, and the island might even show some negative GDP growth after initial projections of 5 to 6% negative growth after projecting 4 to 5% positive growth. How do you think Raul Castro is going to deal with this effectively without losing his grip on power, and could this in fact mean some real economic reforms? Thank you.
I don't have a sort of direct statistics-based response for you. I mean, clearly the exemptions that have allowed U.S. primarily agricultural exports to grow to Cuba have been important enough that they've kind of vaulted the U.S. up in the hierarchy of bilateral trade. As I described earlier, Canadian trade with Cuba continues to be robust, albeit with reference to the comments made by the ambassador, the economic hardship in Cuba at the moment is posing challenges to all Cuba's trading partners who are looking at financing arrangements and so on. So I'd be happy to follow up and get you particular figures if you want to contact me, but that's the best I can do right now.
The honest answer to your spot-on question about how Raul Castro intends to deal with this range of challenges, I don't know. I wouldn't like to be in his shoes because what are the options? And I think the question has to be, will we see the economic openings that happened in the special period that were then those openings were closed down later when the economy was in better shape? I think the speculation has to be that some form of economic reforms will be necessary, but will they happen? I mean, it looks very logical from our perspective, but will he implement them? It's difficult to say. Some on the island speculate that rising popular disaffection will become a serious issue for a government that has a top priority, which is to stay in power. So, How much will they see a need to reform? Who knows?
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for having come. Please thank our panelists for their excellent presentations.